Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. It's a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with David Holding, Principal Healthcare Lead at Microsoft, responsible for healthcare initiatives within the Microsoft Azure Industry Experiences team. He's chair of the Health Information and Management Systems Society Blockchain Healthcare Task Force. He talks about the growing cybersecurity challenges in healthcare and what needs to be done to protect people's health data. Lori Robertson also checks in. The managing editor of FactCheck.org looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also hear us by asking Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with David Holding, Principal Healthcare Lead at Microsoft, on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with David Holding, Principal Healthcare Lead at Microsoft, responsible for healthcare initiatives at the Microsoft Azure Industry Experiences team. He is chair of the HIMSS Blockchain and Healthcare Task Force. He's also an advisor to the British Blockchain Association. Previously, Mr. Holding served as director of healthcare privacy and security at Intel Corporation, where he established the Intel Healthcare Security Readiness Program. He holds several patents in information technology, architecture, and security. He earned his Master's of Applied Science at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver. David, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
It's great to be here. Thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah, you know, you've been at the forefront and really been thinking a lot about data security for a quarter of a century. And I think it's fair to say that the industry has gone through this incredible revolution over the last decade or so of moving from paper to electronic and digital data. Given your background in data and health security, I'm wondering, do you think the industry is ready for the cybersecurity side of having this much data in a digital format? And what are the steps they're going to need to take to be ready for this?
Yeah, you're right. So digitizing paper and sort of moving to electronic health records was the first step, and a lot of organizations have taken that, and we've come a long way. But once that data is digitized, if it's locked away in silos like centralized databases, that's only of limited use, right? And if it's not shared when necessary for health information exchange and other things, then it's limited use in terms of improving healthcare. So I think the opportunity beyond just digitizing health records is to facilitate secure targeted sharing and unlock the potential of the data. And I think cloud computing can play a key role in that. The reality is also that, you know, a lot of healthcare organizations lack the resources, the cybersecurity resources, to adequately secure on-premise infrastructure. So they can get a lot of that with secure platforms, tools, and partnership from Microsoft, and focus more on the higher levels of the stack, the applications, the business, the innovation, and not have to have the capital costs, the same degree of on-premise cybersecurity resources. They can focus more on the healthcare side of things. So, you know, we're really focused on four key business goals of healthcare, right? Reducing healthcare costs is the first one. And really using the cloud can free up a lot of healthcare organizations from the capital expenditure associated with on-premise infrastructure versus in the cloud. But also improving patient outcomes, right? Through the improved accessibility and secure information sharing that you can get with cloud-based data. That gives us an opportunity to improve patient outcomes through better care collaboration and so forth. Improving patient engagement and experiences is another third key goal of healthcare. And so you have things like patient portals that can run in the cloud. You know, can also have intelligent healthcare agents, think chatbots, but healthcare agents can be much broader than that. You know, running all the time in multiple languages, very cost effective, and can really boost patient engagement to that next level of empowering the patient. The fourth sort of key goal we're really focused on is also improving the experience of healthcare professionals, right? And so that's all about intelligent health. It's all about, you know, AI, machine learning for clinical decision support to empower the healthcare professionals. You know, healthcare professionals are getting drowned in data. And the opportunity, I think, with AI machine learning is really to provide, rather than give those those clinicians the raw data and drown them in raw data, use the AI machine learning, in many cases running from the cloud, to get actionable insights from the raw data near real time, so they can be mm-hmm. acted upon if there's a dangerous sort of condition evident in the raw data from the patient. Then they can intercept that really quickly and intervene and hopefully avoid an episode, right, which can really impact the quality of care for the patient, the quality of life. And, you know, I'm thinking heart attack or something like that. If you can intercept and avoid that, that's a major quality of life improvement for mm-hmm. the patient, and definitely a cost reduction mm-hmm. improvement for the healthcare organization as well. Getting back to the cybersecurity side, you know, I think of it as privacy, security, and compliance. So on the privacy side, it's really about transparency, right? A notice to the data subject. And, you know, we often just focus on patients as a data subject, but any kind of personally identifiable information could also be the healthcare professionals, right? We need to be concerned about privacy of that information and being transparent about how it's being used. How is it collected? How is it stored? And, you know, how is it disposed of? You know, we often don't think about, at the end of life of data, disposing of it. And if we don't have a need to have data, you know, disposing of it securely is a good thing to do, right? So privacy to me is really about empowering the data subjects, including the patients, to access, review, amend their data, and so forth. And there's some really interesting opportunities around new technologies like blockchain to really amp that up to the next level and empower patients with their privacy in ways not possible before. You know, as a security professional, we're trained to break it down into CIA, confidentiality, integrity, and availability. So protecting confidentiality of data, we got to make sure it's, you know, adequately secured against unauthorized access, key technologies like access control, encryption, and so forth. On the integrity side, we really got to make sure the data is kept accurate, complete, and up to date, and, you know, isn't tampered with. And so protecting data integrity can be done with things like hash codes and digital signatures. And there's some super interesting capabilities with blockchain and the immutability side, which can really take protecting integrity of data up to the next level. Even things like AI machine learning models, right? As we learn to depend on those, we've got to protect them and make sure they aren't tampered with, make sure the integrity is preserved. Lastly, the availability. This is one that I don't think we've paid enough attention to in healthcare, is protecting the availability of systems and data. And availability is all about ensuring timely and reliable access to systems and data. And prior to ransomware, I think most people equated security with protecting confidentiality and avoiding breaches. And that's certainly a big part of it. But it actually turns out, especially for healthcare providers, protecting availability can actually be far more important, right? If you have a ransomware event and your data is not available because it's encrypted and it's not available because, you know, somebody's trying to extort money out of you for, you know, a ransom, you know, that can be an immediate disruption, and it can really impact the quality of patient care and safety, frankly, as well. Mm-hmm. Now, we also got to think about new types of attacks that they aren't new conceptually, but they're relatively new in healthcare, like DDoS attacks, distributed denial of service attacks. And as we move more and more infrastructure to the cloud, there's fantastic benefits, again, in freeing up healthcare from the burden of on-premise sort of legacy infrastructure maintenance and enabling them to focus more on the healthcare and innovating. But we've got to think about ensuring, how do we ensure the availability of those systems in the cloud? And DDoS, just like ransomware, it's an attack on availability. And, you know, so we can do that with things like redundant connectivity to the cloud. And you can have a cloud mitigation provider that helps you filter out, you know, good legitimate requests from bad requests, and, you know, basically ensure that you're not being drowned by a DDoS sort of blast.
But I think what's most important is you're taking the idea of the quadruple aim of better care, better outcomes, lower costs, and better satisfaction and experience for patients and the people who care for them alike to a more expanded level. And that is very exciting and will
awesome.
Stand us in good stead in the future. I was, you know, particularly struck by some of the work that you're doing in developing these new care delivery clinical support systems, including remote patient monitoring, which has been around for a long time, but we're seeing it taken to whole new levels. And Mark, we had Noelle Lacharite mm-hmm. from Microsoft here with us not too long ago. She was talking about the work that she's doing in voice technology in healthcare, which is also seeing significant growth. So I wonder if I could ask you to talk a little more about programs like the recently launched Microsoft Healthcare Bot Service, which I think you might have referred to in your comments as one example of healthcare agents, and other new tech and voice-enabled interfaces in healthcare. I don't think people have heard so much about that. So maybe just expand on that a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to, and super exciting area of innovation. In general, you know, Microsoft's approach is platforms, tools, and partnerships. So we don't generally create like healthcare end solutions. Think of the healthcare bot service as a tool, and there's some references or demonstrations that can be used to build out healthcare bot capabilities into a myriad of different, you know, partner healthcare solutions. And this is super exciting because, you know, I'm more of an applied person. So technology can be exciting, but what's most interesting to me is how it's applied for the healthcare benefits. And you talked about the quadruple aims you mentioned earlier. So for intelligent healthcare agents, for me, and, you know, the bot service and those kind of capabilities, it's all around patient engagement and experiences, as well as reducing costs. So on the engagement side, the gist of it is really all hours of the day, never sick, multiple languages concurrently, engagement options for patients, even multiple modalities, whether it's a text interface, whether it's a voice interface, it's reaching patients in ways just not possible before, right? And it's not that, you know, the only interface available to patients going forward will be these automated agents, but think of the 80-20 rule. I think 80% of the requests could be handled by these agents, and it really reduces the repetitive noise type requests to the human operators, the nurse on call, for example. If the intelligent agents can help patients, you know, with the basic types of requests, then that also improves the experience of the healthcare professional, because I think some of them get the same question hundreds of times a day, and that's not a good use of their time. If, on the experience side, just the continuous availability of, you know, intelligent healthcare agents is going to really improve the experiences of patients. Picture if you're a mom and you have a sick child and you need help now. And so if it happens to be after hours or on the weekend, or you speak a different language, and, you know, these kinds of agents could really improve the experience of the patient and enable their self-help, right? The patient's motivated to help themselves. So this could also help healthcare professionals, right? Think if they're being credentialed, or if there's other services they need to get updates on, or processes or data. These kind of intelligent agents could really help expedite and empower, you know, healthcare professionals with the actionable insights and information they need essentially near real time, and hopefully avoid, you know, or at least alleviate some of the clinician burnout we're seeing. On the cost reduction side, of course, handling all of these different types of languages concurrently 24/7/365 can really help improve the cost picture, whether it's a healthcare provider, whether it's a payer. Could even be a pharmaceutical or life sciences. Let's say if they're doing a clinical trial and, you know, patients have questions, and, you know, there's wonderful opportunities there as well for cost reduction across all those segments of healthcare.
David, we're in an era of dramatic innovation, and it doesn't seem that the regulatory landscape is keeping up. But I did note that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services announced a new rule that by next year, all patients should be able to have access to their health data delivered to their smartphones within 24 hours at no cost to them. And I'm wondering if you could tell us what that means and whether or not it's doable, given where we are in terms of our technology and our ability to transfer that information safely and securely to patients.
Yeah, so I definitely think it's a good thing, right? Forever we've been talking about the need for patients to own their data, and it's all part of empowering patients and take control of their healthcare, right? They got to have access to their data, and so I think it's a necessary thing. It's more about the cost and how efficiently we can do it, and I think, you know, as an industry, we'll figure out how to do that efficiently and cost-effectively to comply with the regulations. And, you know, cloud can play a key role in that, right? It can enable, again, healthcare to free themselves from those low-level infrastructure on-premise type costs and, you know, focus more on business innovation and applications with cloud-based deployment. So I think, you know, one can really break it down into privacy and security. You know, I think a lot more could be done to empower patients and any data subjects, including healthcare professionals, with their privacy. I think, you know, more could be done around data sovereignty and transborder data flow. You know, if your data is collected, you know, how is it shipped around the world. I don't think HIPAA does as much in that area, as well as patients' control over their data, even the right to be forgotten, right? If a patient goes to a provider and for some reason they opt not to go to that provider anymore and they request for their data to be deleted, I don't think that's something that most healthcare providers do today. But, you know, it is a reasonable request. They might have a legitimate reason for that. I think on the technology side, there's new capabilities available that could really help us amp privacy up to the next level. For example, blockchain offers ways to empower patients with privacy or any data subjects with privacy in ways not possible before. Think of a patient being able to see on blockchain what data is being used, be able to consent or opt in or even opt out, revoke consent, and control their data in ways not possible before. So there's new technologies like blockchain that can pave the way for new policy requirements. On the security side, you know, we've seen the devastation of breaches in healthcare and ransomware, and definitely more could be done on the HIPAA security rule to keep track of, you know, what's going on since, you know, the last revisions to ensure that healthcare organizations are adequately protected. You know, the risk is never fully eliminated. There's always some residual risk, but I think from the policy side, we've got to make sure that healthcare organizations at least have adequate levels of security. I think, you know, more could be done on confidentiality and avoiding breaches for sure. We need to continue with the access control, the encryption, the key management, to track new vulnerabilities, threats, and really approach security as a team, not each organization alone, which is just not reasonable or feasible. But, you know, there's a lot more that could be done on protecting the integrity side of data. I don't think we've paid nearly enough attention there. And, you know, there's wonderful new opportunities with capabilities like blockchain to bolster the integrity protections of all kinds of data and even audit logs and things like that. And then we talked earlier about the need to protect availability of systems and data, and ransomware has taught us that if data is not available or systems are not available and those are mission critical, that can be severely disruptive to healthcare. And on the healthcare provider side, that's a degradation of quality of service for the patient. It could be a patient safety risk, right? Mm-hmm. So one other thing is, I think we need to really approach security from a three-prong standpoint. One is prevent. So do what we can to anticipate threats and vulnerabilities and mitigate those. But then just assume there's going to be some residual risk. And, you know, even though you teach people not to click on links in unsolicited emails, they're going to click at some point. And what you need to be able to do is detect new intrusions, new security incidents very quickly and be able to respond immediately. So there's wonderful new opportunities with technologies like artificial intelligence and machine learning to collect all this telemetry. So think of log data from NetFlow logs and things. That log data is going into a bank of AIs that are looking continuously around the clock for any kinds of new threats and vulnerabilities. And as soon as those are detected, and it's notifying the cybersecurity team, hey, this has just happened. You have a low-level ransomware infection on this medical device. Or, hey, this new server somebody stood up has a wide-open interface. It's vulnerable. And, you know, the ability is detected quickly and use AI machine learning for that and respond quickly to stop loss, mitigate, secure, and remediate. So I think we need to really get in the mindset of do what we can to prevent, but really bolster the detect and respond side of security.
So, David, I want to take it to the level of the individual for a minute. Clearly, personal genomics, self-generated health data are increasingly going to be part of the health record. And we here in our organization are participating in the All of Us project, a million people contributing their genetic data as well as their personal health data, family data. We know that this is something that people are interested in having and in having that information available to their healthcare providers. And yet, when we think of how most people sign off on that data, you know, if somebody hands them a paper, they sign that I've read my HIPAA notice and I agree, right? What should consumers be looking at? You know, now we're talking about the electronic health record having data not just on you, but your antecedents, your ancestors, your relatives. There's a lot of information that people didn't have in there before. What do you say to the person in the street about what should they look for in a healthcare office in order to have reasonable assurance that they're well protected? You've laid out some incredible best practices and some great strategies that we're going to follow out to make healthcare data available and safe. But from the consumer in the street who today just checks off, I read and understand HIPAA, what do we say to them?
So I think, you know, it's from a privacy standpoint, it's about risk reward, right? So think about if you get a request for your data, what is the reward? Like, what's the potential benefit in opting in or consenting to the use of your data? This fantastic capabilities and potential for precision and personalized healthcare, right? Precision medicine, personalized healthcare. And really, to get the benefits of those, you have to consent and opt into sharing your data. Why? Because your data is used to actually tailor, you know, the precision medicine or the personalized healthcare for you, right? What's right for you and your care plan, for your, you know, medications and so forth. So, you know, that's the main reward. Sometimes there's rewards in terms of if you're participating in clinical trials, you can get, you know, updates on the findings directly if you opt into, you know, participation and sharing your data. Sometimes there's compensation involved, and that could be another part of reward that patients could get for participation. But think about the reward and then think about the risk, right? And just understand, you know, I think of it in terms of the full life cycle. Like, what data are you consenting to the use of? How will it be collected? How will it be used? How will it be processed? How will it be stored? Will it be shared at all? That's a super important one. Will it be shared with any other third parties? And then what is done with the data at the end of the life cycle? Is it going to be disposed of, or is somebody just keeping it indefinitely? Obviously, the risk of breaches and things is vastly increased if there's no disposal of the data, if it just lives somewhere indefinitely. So think of the full life cycle like that. But, you know, I think we need to get past just thinking that, you know, there's these huge nebulous privacy risks and we shouldn't opt into anything or consent to anything, because frankly, that will shoot patients in the foot in terms of their ability to participate in precision medicine and personalized healthcare. We've got to opt in, but we've got to do it with our eyes wide open in terms of what are the risks and what are the rewards in terms of benefits to healthcare.
We've been speaking today with David Holding, Principal Healthcare Lead at Microsoft and responsible for healthcare initiatives of the Microsoft Azure Industry Experience team. He is chair of HIMSS Blockchain and Healthcare Task Force. You can learn more about their work by going to azure.microsoft.com, or you can follow him on Twitter at David Holding, and that's H-O-U-L-D-I-N-G. David, thank you for your groundbreaking work as a leader in health data security and for sharing your expertise and wisdom with us on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks very much for the opportunity. Great to speak with you both.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
A false claim about Medicare eligibility and costs has been shared nearly 500,000 times on Facebook. The false claim says, quote, "Why do seniors on Social Security have to pay for Medicare and a supplemental insurance, and the illegals get it all for free? Medicare isn't available for people living in the U.S. illegally. It is available only to citizens and lawful permanent residents who have lived in the U.S. continuously for at least 5 years and meet other criteria, such as being at least 65 years old and having paid Medicare payroll taxes. Also, most seniors don't have to pay for the basic Medicare coverage. There are four parts to Medicare. Medicare Part A covers inpatient stays at hospitals and nursing facilities. It is funded largely through payroll taxes, and those who paid into the system for at least 10 years or are married to someone who paid into the system don't pay premiums. Medicare beneficiaries can purchase additional coverage for doctor's visits and outpatient care through Medicare Part B, or through a private insurance provider with Medicare Advantage. Part B is priced on a sliding scale. Most people who receive Social Security benefits and use Medicare Part B pay $130 per month. Those living in the U.S. illegally may actually provide a net contribution to the Medicare Part A trust fund through taxes. From 2000 to 2011, such immigrants contributed an estimated net total of $35.1 billion to the trust fund. That's according to a study led by a Harvard Medical School professor and published in the Journal of General Internal Medicine. And that's my Fact Check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, Managing Editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Childhood obesity is a national epidemic, but in the South, it's far more prevalent. In Louisiana, for example, over half of the children are either obese or overweight, with many experiencing symptoms such as high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and prediabetes. Louisiana State University researcher Dr. Amanda Stayano has been studying protocols to tackle childhood obesity, tapping into readily available resources that make it easier for kids to adopt better exercise and activity habits. And since video games are ubiquitous in children's lives, she thought that would be a great place to start.
You know, about half of our elementary school students meet the physical activity recommendations of an hour a day of physical activity, and then that drops to less than 10% in middle school. At the same time, we see growing obesity during that time period, and these young children are even starting to develop hypertension and high cholesterol. And so I was trying to think of a way to meet children where they are, to leverage their interests, and figure out a way to make that healthier for them so that they can be more physically active and hopefully lose weight or attain a healthy weight. And children now are spending 7 to 8 hours every day using screen technology. Video games are still very popular, and kids spend hours on end playing these games. So with these new active video games that require physical activity to play, I thought this might be an innovative way to make physical activity and exercise fun, but also to help these children to lose weight and get a healthier heart.
Her team at the Pennington Biomedical Research Center at LSU developed an intervention called Game Squad, giving prescriptions for playing movement video games for a full hour 3 times a week.
In addition to giving the kids these exer games, these active video games to play with, we gave them a few other supports too. We gave them a challenge book, and this would help them to gradually increase the intensity of their physical activity while they played the games. We gave them a fitness coach that they would talk to over their video game, so they didn't actually see their fitness coach face-to-face, but this was a remote support, and the coach would check in with the parent and child once a week and see how they were doing and basically help hold them accountable. And we also gave the kids a step tracker, so that they could objectively keep track of their physical activity throughout the 6 months.
And kids were encouraged to have other family members join them in the movement video games, which added yet another level of engagement, like this young 12-year-old boy who enjoyed gaining a competitive edge over his mom, who was often dancing right alongside him.
I get to speak to my coach. He motivates me. My mom motivates me. I'll have to say, like, 60% of the time I beat her. I love to do disco. Boogie Wonderland with my mom. It really does build up your cardio and stamina for football and for different other sports.
Dr. Stayano says during the 6-month Game Squad trial, over 90% of the kids who were given video game prescriptions and a fitness coach intervention stayed active throughout the study, and the health benefits were. The gaming group reduced their BMI by about 3%, while the control group saw an increase in theirs. Cholesterol was reduced by about 7%, while the control group's collective cholesterol increased by just about that amount. And Stayano says the added bonus was that kids gained confidence and improved self-esteem with their newfound activity. Dr. Stayano is already partnering with health institutions in other parts of the country to scale up and replicate the research. Game Squad, an effective intervention to increase exercise in sedentary and overweight kids, leveraging already existing video games that are designed to get kids up and moving, improving health and fitness for kids in a fun, engaging, and sustainable way.
Well, when this is all over, I'll still do it. We'll keep on continuing doing the games.
Now that's a bright idea.
You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU at Wesleyan University. streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.